California has elected to reduce its emissions of carbon by up to 30% or so, beginning next year. This decision has sparked a stampede to figure out how, and the stampede leads us to ask, can we farm our way to clean air and energy independence?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 705th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Larnaca who are tuned in as we stream along on the radio page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, well, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Good morning.
Folks, the Golden State of California has elected to reduce its emissions of carbon by up to 30% or so, beginning in 2012. And given the state of the calendar, that means pretty much like next year. This election has sparked a stampede to figure out how, and gazillions of taxpayer dollars are to be spent during this stampede. The state's magnificent call to action leads us to ask, can we farm our way to clean air and energy independence? Here to help us dig for an answer, we have Michael Keller. Mike is a biomass energy consultant that I found at the farmer's market. Ha ha. Mike, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael.
So what on earth is a biomass energy consultant?
Well, biomass is pretty much any organic material. It could be woody material. It could be crop material. It can be municipal solid waste or MSW. The two forms that I deal with mostly have to do with woody biomass and agricultural material, and that could be a crop, perennial or annual, or a crop residue, like corn stover, oat straw, wheat straw.
So essentially, anything that was once living is biomass, right?
Exactly.
Good. That's fair enough. Then what is a biomass energy consultant?
Well, the caloric content of plant material or any organic material, that has to be, you know, it's how much energy that can be taken out of that or converted into electricity or biofuel. But the BTU content is how we measure it here in the United States, or the British Thermal Unit. So depending on the material, woody material has a higher energy content than crop material for the most part.
Because it has more sugar?
No, it just has to do with the structure of the plant itself, the cellulose and the lignose within the plant. So it's just how much heat it'll put off, it'll generate when you light it up, I guess.
So you work with as a consultant, is some very interesting companies. Who are they?
I do most of my work with Gavilon. Gavilon is the former trading arm of ConAgra, headquartered in Omaha. They made a formal decision to move into the biomass space about a year ago. And so I'm helping them link supply chains with the demand, the people that would actually buy the biomass.
When we say supply chains, we mean?
If the supply chain is the actual flow of material that's coming to your facility, and it has to show up there on a regular basis, you know.
Which is the interesting element of the business, then,
yeah,
right?
It really is.
How to get something that was once formerly alive to respond in a predictable manner. I mean, it's one thing to find oil and refine it and get it to act in a predictable manner. You know, can get the flow of oil from the ground to the processors and into the consumer's gas tank in a fairly predictable way. But corn stover?
Yeah, the this is the challenge. I mean, when corn-based ethanol and soybean-based biodiesel came on the scene a few years ago, there was already a network of an infrastructure that could deliver that material. But corn stover, basically everything that's left after you take the ear of corn off the plant, you know, you see it standing in fields, that comes in once a year, you know, at the end of the harvest in August, September, October, depending. And you've got to get it off the field and get it delivered to your facility, what's called a conversion facility. where you're using it to turn it into power or biofuel or something like that.
Okay, and that makes this a very interesting endeavor entirely then, because you're working with material that was formerly alive, and so you have to get it from where it is to where it's going to be converted in a timely, predictable, and regular fashion.
Right, and getting it off the field, it's got to be dry. If you bale it wet, and it heats up, it composts, and then you've got to store it. You've got to keep it out of the weather. So logistics, planning, and then, you know, the nutrient replacement cost. If you take, you know, you just strip a field clean of the corn stover, you're taking, you know, arguably nutrients away from the soil. And right. So it's that's one of the considerations. So sustainable biomass is a real hot button.
Yeah, it's a mouthful too,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Sustainable biomass. Woo. So let me ask you: can we farm our way to clean air and energy independence?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's not as quite as easy as it might sound. You've got to.
It doesn't sound easy at all to me.
Well, the United States is extremely blessed with an abundance of the production to, or the ability to produce large amounts of food and feed the world. There's a lot of land that is not in use that can be utilized.
Hey, a quick aside. Why are we so blessed? I mean, you're a person who runs around a lot and looks at biomass. Why is the United States so blessed? This for people who probably haven't thought about it. Why are we so blessed? Why are we more blessed than, for example, China?
We have an incredible topsoil, you know, in between, you know, the intermountain states, you know, say from the Appalachians to the Rockies, from North Dakota down to Texas. It's just beautiful soil. They can do dry land farming, which means we don't need irrigation for the most part. We've been able to apply technology to boost corn yields from 30 bushels an acre to 300 bushels an acre in over the last few decades. We have a river system, an interstate system that we can move materials, and we have year-round ports that can serve Europe, South America, Asia, and they never ice over. So it's, you know, if you had to plan the perfect country, this would probably be it from an agricultural point of view.
And California, likewise, you know, I had the privilege of seeing some of the most fecund areas in the world, like Nile Delta, the Urubamba River Valley in Peru, but the California's Great Central Valley is absolutely stunning in terms of an agricultural resource, because not only do you have the deep topsoil and the wonderful Mediterranean climate, but you have this wonderful range of mountains that's designed specifically to catch water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the canal system or the, you know, irrigation system in this state, California, is far and away, it just blows every other part of the country away in terms of the ability to produce food. I grew up in the Midwest, and when I came to California, I thought I knew what agriculture was, but I just stood there in slack-jawed amazement.
I guess that would be me as well. What a look at this place. Yeah, truly amazing. And yet, we have this wonderful country that was almost designed to be an agricultural paradise. And so we're thinking about, can we take the products of our agriculture and turn them into energy, which we are sorely lacking right now? What about all the rest of the stuff that was formerly alive, like cardboard boxes and trash and all the rest of the detritus of our civilization? Can that be turned into energy as well?
It is, and the big waste companies, noticeably Waste Management, are turning to that. Waste Management as a they've made a decision to move into this space formally. I'm not sure about the other carriers, but they already have the system to aggregate it. They can sort it. Here in California, we do a lot of sorting, and it has to do with the fiber. The, you know, so cardboard, you know, they can take that fiber and turn it into cellulose, milk cartons, that type of thing. So we're already sorting in that, but when we bury organic material, it goes anaerobic and produces methane gas. And that methane gas is what is used to, it's a replacement for natural gas. They can capture some of it, and so you have, you know, these landfills that are they're capturing methane, but anyway, it's very inefficient, so it's better if we don't bury it at all.
Good enough, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about biomass. Can we grow our way to clean air and energy independence? Curious to hear what you have to say. We're listening to Mike Keller, who is a biomass consultant for some very big companies around the world. Travel a lot, too, don't you?
I do. I get to travel a lot.
Which may not be all that much fun, given what I hear about the airlines these days. That being said, we're looking at biomass, and we're wondering, can we grow our way to clean air and energy independence? We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the five things that we can get from growing crops. The food, of course, being one of them, but what about the other four things? Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, there are a bunch of things we can get from growing crops. Food is one of them, of course. We all know about that. Go out into farm country and we see all the food growing. But we can get other things from growing crops as well. We're going to learn about those four other things right now because we're talking with Michael Keller, who's a biomass energy consultant. Michael, what else can we get from growing crops other than food, of course?
In addition to food, you get fuel, biofuel, electricity.
So fuel like biodiesel then?
Yeah, biodiesel would be considered biofuel V1 or version 1.
Okay.
And so now it's you can get renewable diesel, renewable gasoline.
What's
it's
that?
Not ethanol.
What is that?
It's
renewable gasoline. I like it, whatever it is.
Or green gasoline. So you can take a crop and the organic material, the carbon, and they gasify it. They, you know, high temperature, low oxygen, and it creates a syngas, a synthetic
kind of like
gas.
Charcoal.
It is like
making
charcoal. Exactly, except it is very high heat. And they take the gas that comes off that and they reform it. They can. It's advanced technology, and there's a number of companies that do it.
Wow.
But and they can reform it to where it's molecularly or the composition is identical to petroleum diesel or petroleum gasoline.
Really?
Yeah.
And so what's that called?
It's it's called gasification.
Okay.
But there's a number of companies out there that do this, and there's even one that uses sunlight. They use solar power to make green gasoline. So there's
This is some technology we'll get into a little bit deeper. Then so we can get fuel.
Yeah.
You said electricity.
Sure. You instead of coal or natural gas. Then you take crop residue, corn stover we spoke of earlier, and that goes into a boiler and is burned to make steam and turns the turbine and makes electricity.
Yeah.
So the BTU value of that fuel is, you know, that's that depends or that is the limiting factor for how much electricity you can produce, you know, per acre. And it's got so food packing companies. Some of the biggest consumer name companies are switching out their boilers from coal and natural gas to biomass now.
To the leftovers.
Yeah, But they, so it's interesting. So companies like Frito-Lay, as an example, so they use corn to make a lot of their products. And so they take the corn off the field, and the stover, you know, the leftover, the residue right. from the corn plant, they use that to basically produce the heat and the electricity to make their products. And this is going on with, you know, any number of large consumer goods company in the United States and around the world.
And, of course, they have their own feedstocks. You know, they have their own supply chain because that's what they're using to.
Yeah, they build their facilities just like, you know, corn ethanol. They build it right in the middle of the corn belt. They don't, you know, it doesn't pay to ship things.
Right. So chemicals. We can get chemicals out of plants. What kind of chemicals can we get out of plants?
There's a wide array of them. And chemicals and bioplastics, which is the, you know, the two other ones, but they those are much higher margin. You can make much more money out of that if you're a conversion facility. So to turn it into, say, let's say, surfactants. A surfactant is used into making soaps and detergents, and some of the largest consumer companies in the world right now they're switching over to renewable surfactants.
So you can make a lot more money making surfactants than you can ethanol or biodiesel.
Yeah, absolutely. So the so sugar, C5 and C6 sugars that are produced by, say, sweet sorghum or sugar cane. So the companies, you know, like here in the Bay Area, like LS9 and Emeris, they can, just depending on the yeast that they use to ferment that sugar, they can make ethanol, or they can make their fatty alcohol, and the fatty alcohol is what's used to make these renewable surfactants.
Sure. You know, that's where the money's at, then.
Yeah, and it is much more. There's much more money in it, but now you're getting into, you know, sugar cane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is a well-developed industry around the world and heavily regulated here in the United States. You know, and then sweet sorghum. So you know,
sugar beets.
Sugar beets would work. Mm-hmm. Anything that
really has a lot of sugar in it. Then.
Yeah, the C5, C6 sugars.
Well, when you're talking about energy, that's really what you're looking for. Then. Is the sweetness, right? Or the cellulose?
It's the cellulose is part of it, but then you know, the cellulose is part of the cell structure of the plant.
Right.
And then the lignose that's in that plant, it's kind of like the skeleton in our body. So you know, if you look at a leaf, you see the lines on the leaf, that's lignose. And then the parts that are not the lines,
the
that's
pulpy
the cellulose,
stuff,
the pulpy stuff,
the skin.
So they can take and different enzymes to break down the cellulose wall and get the sugar out of it that way.
Right.
And so you can get sugar from cellulose, and that's a much more advanced process, and it's more costly than just taking sugar from sweet, you know, like sorghum or sugar cane.
And that's the difference between. Corn ethanol and cellulosic ethanol, right?
Yeah, corn, I mean, corn ethanol is moonshine that's been despirited. And you know, they've been making that for years.
Sure.
But it's food or fuel, and there's big problems with that.
Yeah.
You know, philosophically as well as just practically.
Well, before we go down that road, let's take the one other thing that we were talking about and that we can get from plants other than just food. We can get plastics.
Yes. And it's just the process for using, you know, enzymes to alter the plant material. And, you know, I'm not, plastics is probably the least advanced of the five different options, food, fuel, electricity, plastics, and chemicals, mm-hmm. green chemistry. But I've not worked directly with anybody that wants to do plastics yet, but it is... The technology is there, and they're looking for places to build these facilities.
Interesting. Well, when you think about it, plastics now come from hydrocarbons,
mm-hmm.
and so I guess if they come from hydrocarbons, they may as well come from carbohydrates.
Sure. Yeah. So, but you know, when you've got these five different uses, and this is probably has more to do with the economics. So you've got to find the land to get your material
right.
to convert. And so if you're going to build a multi-million dollar facility, and like upwards of $100 or $200 million, you know, you've got to tie up that supply around you, and it doesn't matter what it's for, food, fuel, or, you know, the five.
But it does matter because we're competing.
Exactly. And this is what's going on around the world today, and especially in the United States. It's kind of like this game of musical chairs where there's a number of people that are looking at different sites, and not all sites are equal. Some have, you know, if you're on the water, on the Mississippi River, for example, or you're in western Kansas, you know, those are, you know, you're limited to where you can move your end product. So the primo sites, they don't produce food, but they're close to rivers, or they have logistical advantages over other sites. These are the areas that are really gaining a lot of interest right now.
So you have to find some place with relatively low value crops.
Exactly.
Because you can't compete with food would be the top value, right?
Right. Yeah. And right. So you're going to find, you know, less than optimal soil. So it's going to be tight soil or clay, or you're going to have very loose soil where it's, you know, kind of a sandy loam where the water just sinks all the way through.
Something tells me California is not going to be ranked high in this process then, because the land we have here is very valuable land.
Exactly. You know, the opportunity cost, you know, for, you know, Farmer Brown to stop growing whatever it is he's growing and to commit to growing an energy crop. You know, you've got to make, you know, it's got to be worthwhile economically.
Hey, and we're going to find out if it is economically feasible to do this when we come back from the break. Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain with Mike Keller, and a biomass energy consultant. And you care to join us, ask questions, make comments, pick up your phone, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We will be right back. Well, what do you think out there? Do you think we can farm our way to clean air and energy independence? Quite possible. Mike Keller seems to think so, but he's not so certain about whether we can do that in California, most likely someplace else. Why not California, the Golden State, the state that can grow everything all the time, all year long? Why can't we do that here, Mike Keller?
There's a couple of reasons, Michael, and it has to do with the opportunity cost of taking land that's already producing a high value crop, whether it's orchards that are producing nuts,
strawberry fields forever,
the row crops that we have, the high value crops like grapes, it's an economic decision for the person or for the grower that controls that land. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, he's doing it for money. I mean, it's risky enough without trying to bet on a new crop, and then that crop also has to have a customer, a buyer for it on the other side. And it's, you know, and that is just a...
So if you're going to build a $200 million plant, you have to have a steady, reliable supply of biomass to feed it.
Exactly. So a $200 million plant would need several hundred thousand tons a year, and if an act of God prevents that crop from being grown, then you have to have redundancy. You have to have a multiple of that crop in order to get the facility financed, and these are massive plants, and so
wait a minute, can you build a massive plant in California these days?
It's extremely difficult.
So you would have to go up against the Air Resources Board.
Yeah, to get it permitted, to get an air permit, and that in the industry, in the renewable energy industry, even though California leads the way, it's the most difficult state to get an air permit anywhere in the country. And it's and then even if you do get the air permit, then I consider myself an environmentalist. But you get people that have, you know, they're looking through a crack in the door and they think they see the whole room, and they'll protest the, you know, well, gosh, we're protesting because you're gonna do something we don't like, or it's not in my backyard. And so it's an onerous process and not for the faint-hearted.
And that's not all, because California is hard to get to.
Yeah, the getting material in or out of California, the rail, it has very limited rail access. either through the south or through the north, or it comes through Reno. But it goes through, you know, the Tehachapi Loop, you know, out of Barstow and on into Bakersfield.
So the whole notion of hauling raw material, raw biomass, into California to process it, that doesn't seem to make so much sense.
It made a little bit of sense for corn ethanol up until 2006, and there were several large ethanol developers doing business here, and I think there's only one now, Pacific Ethanol. But it really hurt because they were bringing corn in from the Corn Belt, and so
my 20 mule team, right? I thought that.
Well, 110 car unit trains, one a week for a facility.
Wow.
And I mean the energy cost for that is absolutely incredible.
So it's not looking too good for California. But where is it looking good for? What neck of the woods are you exploring as a biomass consultant? You're working with some people who are very serious about this. And where are they looking?
Like I mentioned earlier in the show, the places that have logistical advantages, where it's on a major river, like the Mississippi River, for example, where you have optionality, you can produce it, you can send it down the river, you can send it up the river, you can put it on an interstate and go east and west.
Water's cheap.
So shipping by barge is the cheapest transportation today.
It's just how we get all of our stuff from China.
Exactly. So the Southeast United States, and I define the Southeast United States by Interstate 35, which goes up through Texas, and to about Interstate 40, which cuts through the middle of Tennessee and central Oklahoma. So that section of the country is probably the most valuable for the production of biomass, just because you can move it around, land is cheap, and you don't have solar or wind power down there.
And that section of the country is very much in need of an industry too, right?
It's I would just describe it as grinding poverty. I go to these rural communities, and because of the improvements in agriculture by agribusiness, it's actually cost jobs. And so in these rural communities...
What do you mean by that? Explain that.
The machines now will, the improved automation for growing a crop has eliminated a lot of jobs in agriculture. So we're producing more and at a lower cost, but it's been at a social cost to jobs for really unskilled labor.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of unskilled labor wondering what we're going to do. We have nothing to do, so that's the grinding poverty. Right?
Yeah, and so the emergence of the biomass industry is they're bringing jobs to these communities now, as these facilities, these renewable energy facilities, biofuel facilities are built or proposed, they bring hundreds of jobs to these areas. So it's very interesting sociologically as well as environmentally.
So the great hope then is for the southeast of the United States, because we have the cheap land, we have the climate, we have the transportation infrastructure. We have. What about the technology? Do we have technology that can do this efficiently enough to make it make sense?
Without a doubt, it is. It's exciting. It just is very exciting to see what the technological developments that are really coming to the forefront, especially in biofuel production and renewable chemicals.
What kind of technologies are coming to the fore?
Well, you see companies like Amyris, LS9, the Gevo, people that are producing, the next generation biofuels. And, the cost, they've been able to do it for a long time, but the production cost on a per gallon basis just keeps steadily coming down as they improve the efficiencies. And so...
kind of technologies are they using then? Are we talking cellulosic ethanol, where they use some kind of enzyme to break down the cellulose? Is that what we're talking about?
That's one of the categories. The other is the gasification I spoke
of. Right.
So it's actually using a very basic technology that was developed in World War II by Germany, Fischer-Tropsch.
Wow.
So they're taking Fischer-Tropsch... FT to gasify organic material and turn it into any number of different products.
And when we talk about World War II, of course, Germany did not have access to much petroleum,
mm-hmm.
and so had to rely on gasification.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we revived that technology and are bringing it to the fore here.
Yeah, it's amazing that you know, they were so advanced back then. You know, it's you know, a misuse of the technology, but they were they really set the standard, or set the stage for what we're using today.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to ask you about something that we talked about off the air, which was MacGyver technology. So do stay tuned. We'll learn all about MacGyver technologies and energy, and you and I. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Mike Keller, energy biomass consultant. And you, if you'd like to join us today, you certainly may. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phones and join us if you dare. Right back. Do stay tuned. Welcome back out there. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here with Mike Keller, energy biomass consultant. Mike is in the business of finding feedstocks and marrying the feedstock with a conversion technology, the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess financiers must be also part of that element, too. It takes three legs to make a good stool, right? You have to have the feedstock. You have to have the technology, and then you have to have the money
mm-hmm.
to build the plant. Are these plants $200
million? $200
million
or more. I mean, they're not all that expensive, but even a $5 or a $10 million facility is going to be scrutinized by the financiers that are, you know, putting the money into it.
And financiers really must have a tough one, too, because They're looking at financing a plant that's going to cost $200 million plus, and then they have to see that, one, that the technology is going to be sufficient to be able to produce the energy,
mm-hmm.
and two, that the feedstock for that plant is going to be sufficiently reliable that they can bet $200 million on it.
Yeah, it's not like you building a factory that's going to make widgets where that's fueled by natural gas. So the gas company comes out and puts the line in, and the gas is there, you know, day in, day out. There's not an issue with it. But to make sure that you're going to have a steady supply of biomass, whether it's woody or crop or another facility, is infinitely more complex, and it presents a whole new category of risk that they're really trying to figure it out today.
Well, okay, one quick one before we go to the phones. What do you mean by MacGyver technologies?
You're going to put a facility in, you know, pick a town, and, you know, you're confined or you're bound by what's around you in a 25 or a 50-mile radius, and that's what you have to deal with. It's like, you know, like a MacGyver in a room, and he's got a paperclip, a Band-Aid and a bicycle, and he's got to escape somehow using all those things. So they have to work with what they've got. So site location is you know, that's the three most important things for site location is what do you have, what do you have, what do you have?
What do you have, what do you have? Location, location, location. Well, speaking of what we have a phone caller, Jim from Montreal. Jim, welcome to the Food Chain. Michael Olson and Mike Keller, go ahead.
Hi, so my name is Jim Thomas. I work for an organization called the Etc. Group. We've just produced a report that the Etc. Group.
Etc.
Yeah, we've just produced a report that's extremely critical of much of what you're talking about. There's a lot of myths here around biomass that are being repeated, and I'd like to try and question some of those. Particularly, you're saying that can we farm our way to clean air and try and deal with create carbon neutral agriculture? Well, there's nothing particularly carbon neutral about biomass. When you burn biomass, you release pretty much as much carbon dioxide as you do when you burn petroleum or when you burn coal. Even in fact, if it's wet biomass, it can sometimes be.
But what about
more.
When you're growing the biomass? Aren't you converting carbon dioxide into plants? I mean, aren't you making oxygen then?
So that's the theory, of course, that
right.
it's offset by plants that you grow subsequently. But you have to remember that the process of agriculture is in itself, particularly, you know, the sort of industrial agriculture that we're familiar with in North America.
We have tractors.
Is it, We have not just tractors. When we turn over the soil, we release a lot of carbon dioxide. Most carbon is stored in the soil, and particularly if you're taking more biomass off the land, as Michael mentioned, you're going to be using more fertilizers. You'll be using therefore nitrous oxide. You're having released nitrous oxide from those fertilizers, which is 300 times stronger as a climate-changing gas than carbon dioxide.
So you've got a number of places. You don't seem too optimistic.
No, not at all. And some of the procedures which we've been talking about today, you know, for example, superheating biomass in order to produce fissotropsch or similar biofuels, well, the energy balance just doesn't work on those. And when you begin adding in, the energy for tractors, the energy for hauling biomass, it's heavy stuff and it doesn't have much energy in it. And then you look at the amount of releases that you're going to get from production of fertilizers as well as releases from fertilizers and so forth. You're not ultimately looking at a great gain here.
Okay, well, let's have Mike Keller respond to that, Mike.
Well, not all biomass is created equal. You know, there.
Like George Orwell, right? All animals are created equal, but some are more equal than others. Yeah.
The woody biomass. I mean, you can calculate. You know what you can definitely determine what the carbon sequestration is from a tree. Annual crops that are grown specifically to produce biomass. The energy balance. The energy emitted to grow that crop is far greater than probably what you're going to get out. Which is why I think perennial crops, perennial grasses, and I'll just talk about, you know, crop material for a moment. So a perennial grass where you plant it one time, it's going to be carbon negative oftentimes. So, and I'm thinking of, or speaking of switchgrass and miscanthus. So
that means it'll make more oxygen than it does carbon dioxide.
It'll fix more carbon in the soil. It'll take it more out of the air than it does that it takes to grow it.
Hey, Jim, can you hold on?
Yeah, sure.
We're going to have to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We've got a bunch of callers. We've got calls from all over the country here coming in. And you, of course, are invited to participate as well. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Michael Olson with Mike Keller, the biomass energy consultant. And we're talking about whether we can indeed farm our way to clean air and energy independence. Boy, what a dream, huh? Love it. Can we do it? We will be right back to find out. Well, Mike Keller thinks it's possible to farm our way to clean air and energy independence, but Jim in Montreal doesn't think it's too likely. Isn't that right, Jim?
Sorry, I didn't catch the question. Can you say it again?
Well, you don't think it's too likely, then, that we can farm our way to clean air and energy independence?
No, quite the opposite. I think giving over all of our agriculture to large companies like ConAgra to turn it into biomass sources is actually going to move us away from dealing with climate change. It's going to move us away from feeding people. It's basically just giving a new revenue stream to some of these large companies without really solving our problems.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling and letting us know what you think. We really appreciate it. Well, Mike, there you go. Do you see any rainbow at all?
Well, you know, that was not an entirely accurate statement by Jim, and I do respect his opinions. He made some very good points. But the whole idea is to not divert land from food production. I mean, you just can't do that and have a, quote, sustainable crop. The emissions associated with annual crops, you get the full weight of the emissions put on that crop. Example, sweet sorghum, for example. But so perennial grasses, you plant it once, the nutrients return to the soil, you know, when they, you know, at the end of each season. Mm-hmm. So when they turn brown, it's not like corn or wheat where you chop the nutrients off and you take it with you when you take that.
Well, speaking of grasses, where do they grow better grass than Kansas? Isn't that right, Larry?
Well, we've got a lot of grass in Kansas. There's no doubt about that.
And what do you think about this whole notion of using biomass to create energy?
Well, I've been highly involved in it for a number of years, and I would tell you that, number one, you're previous caller from Canada is entirely misinformed. It isn't a theory as to whether or not plants take in carbon and store it within the plant and within the soil, because they do. It's fact. And annual
crops. It's the magic of life, isn't it?
It absolutely is the magic of life, and it goes on every day, and we are wasting a mountain of energy that we're not utilizing. We talk about returning it to the soil, but most of that residue actually decays back into the atmosphere, and it is part of the greenhouse gas effect. And we could much better utilize our annual crop residues and the waste that is there in huge volumes that would improve our farming practices, increase our total food production, and make the world a much better place. But it takes informed people working hard to overcome so much of the misinformation that's out there.
Mike Keller thinks it's going to happen in the southeast of the country. Do you see any hope for Kansas?
Kansas is close behind the southeast, and all of the research work that I have seen as far as how much available material there is. I'm not very informed when it comes to the woody biomass, if that's what we're talking about, but some of the grasses, I have the largest miscanthus field in the nation, 4 miles from my house. So in Kansas, we're doing it. It is going forward. That residues are the low-hanging fruit that will be first.
Yeah, that put a big smile on Mike Keller's face. Thanks for the call, Larry in Kansas. Really appreciate it. And best of luck to you folks out there in the heartland. You have the soil. You have the infrastructure. Go for it. Thank you, Larry. Mike Keller, thank you so much for joining us on the Food Chain today. It went by too fast. I had a bunch of calls that we missed, but that's the way of it. You know, sometimes it just works like that. But so can we farm our way to clean air and energy independence?
Absolutely. The billion-ton study done in 2005 and has been updated since then, but we absolutely can.
There you go. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember what? Remember, cheap food isn't. That's what you remember. Thank you so much, Mike Keller. Thank you all for tuning in.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.